Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
The sun along the mountain bows, the yellow river seaward flows. You will enjoy a grander sight by climbing to a greater height. Wang Jiwan. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. I hope you will enjoy and peruse our backlog. And if you're a returning listener, thank you guys as always. I really appreciate the support. This week, we will be continuing our kind of overview and study of Neolithic cultures along the Yellow River, specifically the Yangshao culture. And that is between the years of 6 and about 4000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. But prior to that, though, I did have one little quick thing I want to get into. It's a little piece of feedback. It's not going to take long, only a couple of seconds here. When I start to go over viewer feedback or things like that in going forward, I'm going to try to put a timestamp in the episode descriptions about when I actually get on topic. So if people are, you know, if you're just testing out the show, you might want to just jump to that part to kind of get into the meat and potatoes of the episode. Whereas, you know, our regular listeners, you might have questions about the last episode. But that's based on some feedback I got on the episode, and I just want to make sure, you know, people are aware going forward when that's going to start. Thankfully, though, don't really have too much to go over from last week, so I don't need to make that note. So let's go ahead and dive on into the Yangshao culture. Standard disclaimers about humans living more mobile hunter-gatherer slash pastoralist lifestyles apply, as always. Now, the Yangshao name comes from name of the town in the modern Hainan province of China, where the culture was first discovered. The name could be read a few ways, I guess, but the ones that make the most sense to me would be something like looking forward to spring or admirable spring. Yang is like, you can basically, it's like your head looking forward, but it can also mean you're admiring something. It can mean both of those things, though I think some of those readings are a little bit older. It's not usually used too much in modern Chinese. And then Shang is, again, there's a couple different ways you can read it. It could, but it's mostly today read just as spring. And both Yang and Shao are both also surnames. So maybe it's a place where the Yang and Shao lived. The Yang and Shao live, though I don't think that's the case very much. Now, the site was first excavated in the very early 1920s. I think it started in 1921. And the excavation was led by a Swede, Johan Gunnar Andersson, at the invitation of the then-current Chinese government. And he was responsible for a number of groundbreaking finds in China, like the discovery of Peking Man. He found, like, their teeth initially, and then of course, you know, later other fossils were discovered, and now you have essentially a collection of a few different hominids belonging to that designation. Now, he also developed some theories about the origins of what would become the Chinese people based on numerous finds, like non-local quartz and artistic designs on some of the pottery he found at the Yangshao sites. He was of the opinion that the Yangshao had migrated through Central Asia from the Middle East. And this theory fits in with, at the time, the very popular and very widespread idea of the Neolithic Revolution that started in one location in the Middle East and then was spread in waves by people leaving that region. Now, Anderson's theory caused massive turbulence and discussion in a lot of circles, especially in China. Now, a number of Chinese archaeologists, people like Li Ji, Fu Xinian, and Liang Xiong, had been excavating other sites from slightly more recent history, things that there had been historical records about, but they believed their culture had developed independently in the region. Now, with the benefit of 100 or so more years of digging and research and things like DNA, it shows that the Chinese archaeologists got far more right about their theories about the origins of Chinese people, you know, as a whole. They got things far more right. Though, of course, they weren't 100% right about their theories, and Anderson wasn't 100% wrong either. People did travel for both migration and trade into the region via the route he described, though obviously during the time frame we'll be talking about this episode, it is not being done often or by a large amount of people. Basically, most of the people we'll be talking about and have been talking about in this part of what is now China have been here for quite some time, though that's not to say, of course, that maybe they didn't have some people leaving the route leaving the region via the route he described, or that you didn't have maybe a couple of people coming in via that route, but by and large, most people have been here for quite some time. Now, due to how early the Yangshao has been found, and due to several other factors, some people consider this to be the origin point for Chinese civilization. And what is, you know, kind of more is that basically that these people lit the torch that has been carried straight forward, uninterrupted, since it first developed along the shores of what is now, I think, the Wei and Bahe rivers, which are both part of, again, the larger Yellow River system. You know, I'm sure most of you have either heard or read someone saying something like, you know, China is great because of their 5,000 years of uninterrupted history, or outsiders can't really understand China because they have over 5,000 years of history, which lines up with the very final stage of Yangshao development. Now, to be very clear, Chinese civilization is extremely old. They're the oldest still developing civilization by quite a margin. But is the claim that, you know, they have 5,000 years of history true? In short, no. In detail, you know, they're not entirely wrong. There probably are some facets of their civilization that existed at very early stages during parts of the Yangshao period and certain sites at the Yangshao. I guess it really depends on what you're categorizing as Chinese. Then, of course, based on what they say is Chinese, you kind of have to sort of trace back what they're including in that criteria as far as we can. In most cases, I would imagine that what they list are probably not nearly as old as, you know, they would think. Now, I'm not just picking on Chinese nationalists or people who fall for, you know, CCP propaganda here, but other people, you know, other people from other cultures do make similar connections to older cultures or things like that. But again, the 5,000 year range, in my opinion, is not correct. I personally date the origin of what we would consider China and Chinese civilization to sometime slightly before the Shang dynasty starts, which is probably, you know, we're talking 36,000, 3,500 years old, which, again, to credit the Chinese people, is very old and by far the oldest still developing civilization. Now, among Neolithic cultures that we've discussed, and I should also point out, again, another reason that I don't buy into the Yangshao being, you know, the single origin point is because since then we've discovered older cultures and we've talked about them these last few episodes and in last, you know, I guess last season's run as well. But that all that being said, Yangshao probably did contribute more to, I guess, the origin of urban civilization along the Yellow River than any of the other Neolithic cultures we've discussed on this show so far. And a couple of more that we will be covering in the next few episodes. Again, I don't think this counts as, you know, Chinese, but again, I guess it does depend on what is meant when you're talking about Chinese or China. However, as we've been talking about the last few episodes, the various cultures we've discussed have not been existing in a vacuum. And there are many open questions about the level of interconnection and relationships between these various cultures. And, as we will see, even the Yangshao, who archaeologists are much more certain than, say, sites like Dadiwan or the Pelegong and Jiahu sites, archaeologists are very, very convinced that the Yangshao sites had very deep material connections between each other. But all that being said, none of these sites were monolithic, and they all had regional variations, you know, that may have represented different competing, I won't want to say political, but like proto-political or social variations. And there's not any kind of shared, at least from what we can see in the, you know, in the archaeological record, there's not any kind of primeval ethnic or national identity. Hell, it's possible that, you know, different Yangshao villages closer, you know, close to each other had more problems with their direct neighbors than they did, you know, people three valleys over that made the same kind of pottery. So don't think of the Yangshao as kind of the basis for Chinese civilization. Think of the Yangshao as one Yellow River proto-civilization that expands and takes over or replaces the other groups that we have talked about or will talk about, and then develops and splits into numerous smaller semi-urban or proto-urban-based societies. Then those develop their own individual cultures, and then they can kind of compete and, you know, play off of each other, and then eventually you work your way up to the Shang dynasty. But we'll discuss Chinese historiography and like their understanding of their own past. I don't know if we'll get to it this episode. That might be kind of at the end of everything for this season, but we'll see. There is some stuff I might touch on later, but for now, let's continue talking about the Yangshao, what we actually know about them. Now, the Yangshao are an incredibly long-lasting and widespread culture in the grand scheme of Neolithic cultures. That is not to say, though, that they were always very widespread. Initially, they are focused right down the Yellow River, or specifically the Wei River part of the larger Yellow River system. Technically speaking, the Yellow River meets the Wei River further downstream. The Yellow River, remember, forms in the kind of Tibetan highlands, and it actually kind of flows north, and then it kind of has this long, big curve where it eventually starts to turn directly, almost completely south. And it's at that point the Yellow River meets several different streams, the largest being the Wei, Jing, and Luo rivers. The Wei being the longest of those three. And the Wei kind of forms in, I think it's modern Gansu province. The exact meaning of the name I couldn't quite, I can't quite say. I'm sure there's a very easy explanation for it. I just wasn't able to find it through my standard searches. But the character, remember, Chinese characters are not alphabetical. They are for words, concepts, things like that. The character they use for the Wei River is specifically meant to denote the Wei River. But it's a combination of the radical for water, shui, and the word Wei, which can mean stomach. It can also mean like a bird's gizzard. And it's also like a constellation. Sometimes I've seen the constellation translated as both tail and stomach. So I'm assuming the origin of the river has some kind of tie to the stomach or something along those lines. What that exactly would be, I don't know. But that's kind of what I was able to figure out. Regardless, the Wei portion, the Wei River portion of the Yellow River is where you begin to see the earliest sites of the Yangshao habitation. And again, like I said, the Yangshao is a very long-lasting culture. It's kind of listed as lasting from 5,000 to 3,000 BC. And it will... archaeologists divide it up into three separate phases. The longest, and the phase we'll be covering for this season, is the Bon Po phase. And this lasts between 5 and 4,000 BC, BCE. And it initially, again, is right along the Wei River in what is now the modern Shanxi province. This origin for the Yangshao, or the starting phase, is known as the Bon Po phase. That is named for the type site of Bon Po, which is actually it's in the suburbs of the city of Xi'an, which is the capital of the modern-day Shanxi province. Historically, at one point, it was the capital for at least, I think, a couple of dynasties. I know that for a very for a period of time, Xi'an was the capital of the Han dynasty, and that at that point in time, the city was referred to as Chang'an. But Bon Po, back to the subject hand. Sorry for rambling a little there. Bon Po was first discovered in 1953. Now, they found this when they were, I guess, building or clearing land to build a new factory in the area. And then, you know, they discovered a large amount of artifacts, like over 10,000, I think. And in fact, the site itself has become the site of a very popular museum in China. I think it's like the largest, most visited prehistoric period museum in all of China. But after they discovered those artifacts, they called in, an archaeologist, Shi Jingmeng, and he kind of was in charge of the excavation. They ended up drafting, like, the people who were clearing out the land for the factory. They ended up drafting them to kind of become citizen diggers / archaeologists. It was a very communal effort, which, you know, very in keeping with the CCP ethos at the time. But they excavated a very large amount of the site, but I think, technically speaking, there's still a huge portion of the area that has not been fully excavated. That's, again, partly due to its location as being in the suburbs of one of China's largest, most important cities. But they have, of course, continued excavations off and on over the years, but they're taking it slow as they can. But the site was initially occupied sometime between 4,700 and 4,500. There's a little bit of debate on when it was first permanently settled. It could have been used, you know, for brief periods, starting again at that earlier date, the 4,700. But by 4,500, it becomes, you know, a full, like, settled site. It covered somewhere between 12 to 16 acres. And it was surrounded by a ditch, or at least they think it was like a moat. I think it was about 16 to 21 feet wide, which for my metric listeners, which is 5 to 6 meters. So they didn't have walls at this period, but they did have need of a moat. What that was for, probably to help them corral animals, but also probably there was a defensive element to it as well. But there are several sites, you know, along the Wei River Valley that are also considered part of the Bon Po that are slightly older. But I think Bon Po kind of, you know, again, it was the first one discovered, showing this earliest stage of Yang Shao development. And because it was so close to Xi'an, you know, it got kind of the pride of place in the literature. The name means something like half hill or half slope hill, something along those lines. And there are other sites, again, not too far from Bon Po, that some are a little bit older, some a little bit later. The big ones, though, are Zhangjai, Beisholing, and even Dadi Wan eventually is reoccupied by people with Bon Sho tools and things like that. Though I think they don't occupy it until the very end of this season. And Dadi Wan doesn't really get too large again until the next period of Yang Shao development, which we'll go into at a later date. But Bon Po, in addition to having, you know, the defensive moat, it has all what you would expect from a permanent settlement. There are homes. They are almost all circular or oval-shaped. The floors would be dug down about a meter, which is like 3 feet deep. And then they would actually place kind of like a clay flooring over those. And then kind of in the centers of the homes, they would have pillars. Depending on the size, it would have between 1 to 6 wooden pillars kind of as a support structure. And then they would essentially create thatched roofs over those structures. So they kind of had like a nice little awning. They had, I think, openings up in the center. You know, they would be very cozy. You wouldn't have to worry about water too much, unless, you know, it was a flood. But, like, in terms of, like, protection from rain and things like that, they were pretty well insulated. You also had kind of pits, storage pits that they would use to store, grains, millet in this case. I think they were almost entirely reliant on millet at these locations, and that includes foxtail and broomcorn millet, and they were very well, you know, very well insulated as well, so they didn't have to worry too much about spoilage. In terms of communal buildings, I haven't seen anything at the earliest phase mentioned at any of these sites, but there may have been larger dwellings that were, you know, that were used for that, like a communal meeting space. They did have kilns. Being like right around the river, they had access to a lot of different clay. And very early on in the Yang Shao culture, they do develop a very wide variety of pottery, both in terms of shape, both in terms of quality. You know, they had some higher quality stuff compared to some of the other cultures we've talked about this season. Though, again, during this period, this early phase, I don't know if it quite gets to, you know, say, that glazed kind of pottery look. I don't know that they get that during this period, but they do decorate it quite nicely too. I think their pottery is very, very pleasing to look at. Artistically speaking, they have animal motifs. They do kind of these human faces with kind of these geometric patterns around them. They mixed in different colors. They had they painted them black. They kind of had a white. Their pottery comes in a couple of different colors, including red and gray. And they also, again, created kilns. These kilns were on the outskirts of the villages, not in the villages directly. This led, at the time these were initially discovered in the 50s, this was kind of heavily promoted by political authorities as being an example of early communal working, community working together, mass producing items. That's certainly possible, and I do think earlier societies are more likely to be communal than not, but it's also, the simple fact that their homes are all wood. They may not have wanted, kilns, in their homes or in, a very heavily wooded area. So it may have been a safety measure as well. How many people they had dedicated to making pottery is, also debated. Did everyone make pottery? Or was it only people who were skilled enough? Was it only women? Was it women and men? Was it only men? Usually, with a lot of pottery stuff, at least, anthropologically speaking, a lot of early pottery societies are more, not urban, but more pastoral or rural settlements, you typically see women more involved with the making of pottery than men. That's not to say men didn't, but again, there's no real evidence one way or the other. And that kind of ties into what we were talking about last week with the idea that, this was a more matriarchal society, which this actually might have a little bit of evidence for that, though. Again, it is debated. They have found communal burial plots also on the outsides of the villages in kind of rudimentary graveyards. Women were buried typically, not always, but in some cases, women are found with more grave goods than men. Now, that could have been a sign of elevated status. It could have also just been like people were kind of buried with what they were associated with. If women were more heavily involved in, preparing, plant-based foods, crops, things like that, they may have been buried with things that they worked with in life. Whereas, the men, perhaps, if they were hunters, they may have been buried with wooden spears or tools that have degraded in the ground. So it is possible that this was matriarchal, unlike these other sites, this one actually has a little bit of evidence to potentially back it up. Though, again, it's debated, and more modern interpretations in China don't really emphasize this aspect too much. Children were not buried in these communal pits. Typically speaking, children would be buried in kind of these large pottery pieces and buried kind of in the foundations or kind of on the outskirts of the homes themselves. Children also ranked some grave goods. They would have toys buried with them and things like that. Though that's not always the case. Sometimes they were just buried without anything kind of that stands out. But, occasionally you'll find balls buried with them and things like that, which, make of that what you will. Now, while they did practice agriculture, they were also hunters and gatherers of wild game and things like that. In fact, sometimes, or some periods, it seems like their reliance on agriculture dropped, and they appeared to rely more on wild sources of food, or they were relying more on domesticated animals like dogs and pigs, though. So this is very experimental in terms of how they're gaining their food. You know, they may have used up, you know, fertility of the land. They may have let fields fallow for a few years while they relied more on wild sources. But it's not a direct, immediate adaptation of full-scale agriculture, at least during this phase. There, a lot of these sites bounce back and forth between being agriculture and hunting and gathering. So make of that what you will. Now, they do eventually develop the wheel, the pottery wheel, excuse me. But this is also something that's kind of debated. A lot of their earliest pottery is done with the coiling technique, where you'll basically make a coil of clay. You'll then set another coil around it, and then another, and then another. Now, again, they do eventually develop the pottery wheel, and they're the first people to use that in what is now China. But again, there's debate if that's part of the Bon Po phase or if this is in that next period that we'll be talking about in the future. But the pottery wheel does show up at Bon Po, though, again, the period on that is debated. They also were practicing creating cloth. There is, again, evidence of sewing. They have needles, things like that. Though, unfortunately, we don't really have too much in the way of what their fabrics were made of, what they were using to create. We found the needles. We found, imprints on their pottery of, you know, ropes and things like that being wrapped around them. I don't think they've been able to discover at this early stage what those ropes were made of, unfortunately. They haven't really found much in the way of testable fibers. So, unfortunately, we don't know that aspect. But, again, we do know that they are sewing, at least to some level. In terms of population, it doesn't seem like any one of their sites becomes especially massive. I think, you know, on average, there's probably maybe 100 people at these sites at any given time. Some of them may be a little bit larger at certain periods. Some of them may be a little bit smaller than that. It's hard to say for sure, at least from what I've been able to read. But they are successful. They are expanding both east and west along the river valley. Again, they do reoccupy Dadiwan in this phase. So they are, that's the evidence of them moving west. And then in the east, they do, again, they get to where Yangshao is. I think Yangshao is probably like about 250, I think, kilometers east or of Bon Po. But they're basically, you know, probably reaching a certain point where they're like, we can't really expand the village, so, you know, they send probably a couple of families out in to a specific direction and see if they can find another place to live, or perhaps they discovered sites that might be more suitable to agriculture than where they're currently living, and they're like, well, you know, that might be a place where we can try and growing things, and then, you know, they don't abandon the old sites. They just kind of say, okay, we'll practice agriculture here. Here can stay, you know, people who are more comfortable with hunting and gathering. And then, you know, as the land returns to fertility, they begin to readopt agriculture at a later date. Bon Po is occupied till about 3,600. So about 400 years after the end of this season. I will go ahead and kind of tie in the end of this site, because this doesn't last too much longer into the next phase. Bon Po is abandoned very quickly. It's possible there was a flood. It's possible that it just wasn't large enough to support their growing population. There may have been pressure from other sites that they were trying, you know, to deal with. It's hard to say exactly why it's abandoned, but it is abandoned very quickly. And maybe once you know, once they finish excavating the site, they might find more evidence of why the site was abandoned. But it is abandoned kind of at that transition from the first phase into the second phase of the Yang Shao culture. There is no evidence of alcohol production. They could have made alcohol, but we don't see any signs of that. And, you know, you can make alcohol from millet, but it's just there's no real evidence of it one way or another. But that kind of covers the first phase of the Yang Shao. But there are a couple of other things I do want to talk about. One, the Yang Shao is one of those cultures that is considered a probable home or a possible homeland for the Sino-Tibetan language, which again will eventually split into a couple of different branches. The Yang Shao culture is, I think, the one that most people associate with the Chinese language, or, you know, where the Chinese language originated, or at least the proto-Chinese language originated, though there are people who do think it was the Xishan, which we talked about them already. They were up north at the Yellow River. And some people think, actually, the Yang Shao might have been at one part, or at least part of the Yang Shao population, may have been immigrants from the Xishan culture. The Xishan were up a further north where the Yellow River starts to move south. So it's possible, once the Xishan sites were abandoned, that their population followed the Yellow River south, and then they headed east, or excuse me, headed west into the Wei River Valley, the Luo River Valley, and the other kind of upriver spots. And then that they established what will eventually become Yang Shao settlements. Though that is debated, it is possible. And, you know, again, it, you know, that does make it possible that, you know, both are kind of origin points for the Chinese language. So even if you think the Xishan are, you know, the original quote unquote Chinese speakers or proto Chinese speakers or Sino Tibetan speakers, whatever you want to refer to them as, it's, you know, it's possible that they initially lived at the Xishan sites, and then they moved south and east where they developed their language further, and then they began to spread out from there. And that leads me into writing, or the potential for proto-writing. I mentioned that the that there's a lot of pottery with these different geometric symbols on it. Some people think that this is kind of a form of proto-writing. Most people don't buy that, though. The symbols could just be motifs. There are some things that do look like they could be representative of crops or humanoid figures, or they could just be designs that the Yang Shao people thought were pleasing, though. Again, you get into the whole ritual, not ritual thing. And these symbols don't really correlate to any modern Chinese characters, because we do have early Chinese writing. We have those Shang characters. And those are, you know, those can easily be traced to more modern characters in Chinese writing. Whereas the Yang Shao, it's not quite clear, and they do disappear at periods. So, you know, is that really the basis for writing? Probably not. Again, it's kind of a fringe theory. Not everyone agrees with it, but that has been put out there. I just wanted to, you know, list that as a possible possibility. But again, not very widely accepted, even in China. So, but yeah, I think that kind of covers the Yang Shao, or at least the first phase of the Yang Shao, the Banpo phase. We will continue on next week in our kind of overview of Neolithic China, where we'll be talking about the Neolithic cultures of the lower Yellow River. This is the Houli, Beijing, and Dawanko cultures. But I do want to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you've liked the episode, and I hope you will enjoy it. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. And I will try and do with that what I can. You can comment on my YouTube videos. You can send me a direct message on Twitter/X. Sorry, I haven't been posting there recently. I'm going to try and do a better job, but it doesn't feel like, you know, it's affected the show, like, posting there too much. It's about the same regardless, so. But I do appreciate the feedback wherever I can get it. You can also reach me via email at war@revpod@gmail.com. Yeah, I appreciate you guys for showing up. Please like, subscribe, download, rate 5 stars, whatever you do on whatever platform you listen on. It would really help the channel out and see some growth. We've gained a few more subscribers on YouTube. I appreciate everyone who's followed through on there. As well as Spotify. Looks like it's seen an uptick in downloads as well. So maybe the later start time or live time for the episodes is doing its job. But I appreciate you guys for showing up. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from wherever you're listening to or whenever you're listening to this episode. Next week's episode should not be affected by the Memorial Day weekend. It may be, but I don't think it will be. We'll see. But again, thank you all for joining me. I'll see everyone next time. Peace.